You're listening to Stories About People. This story is called The Big Boy Lives in a Suburb of Paris by Susie Carlick.
The big boy is 36 years old now and autonomous. While he does not work for himself, everything he does is for himself. He makes his own hours.
I can get my work done in 2 hours if I want.
He works from home.
With today's technology, there is no place I ever really need to be, so I can be everywhere.
He lives on his own.
I thought about subletting when I travel, but I have too many papers I don't want people to see.
The big boy facilitates constructive communication in every language between his company and its customers all over the world. He does this from his 60 square meter apartment. He lives in a suburb of Paris.
I've been living here for almost 4 years now, and I know where everything is, so I guess this is home.
The big boy is lonely.
4 years ago, when the big boy moved to this suburb, he joined the local sports club.
It's the biggest sports club in all of Paris. There are 200 different classes you can take.
But he doesn't use it that much because it's not very much fun alone. He owns 2 tennis rackets in case he finds someone to play tennis with him. He's pretty sure of the terrible velocity of his serve.
I can't really compare it to anyone's professionally, but nobody has ever returned my serve, so I pull back a lot. If you measured the speed, you would probably find it as fast as Federer's or Nadal's. Will you go to the pool with me now?
The big boy did try all the water slides in the sports club's outdoor pool area when he first joined, and he gave mini golf a go. But he didn't see much point in either one of these activities. Except maybe the water slides he could see some point in. But he's had a hard time articulating exactly what that point is, even though he graduated with a degree in communications.
My friends at college would introduce me by saying, "This guy studies harder than anyone we know."
The big boy has no friends. He claims it's because he works a lot, even though he could get his work done in 2 hours if he wanted. He is fond of recounting tales of the toys he has purchased and destroyed. Each one, he explains, bought as a gift for a child, but the children are never interested in the toys he buys, so he winds up playing with them instead and breaking them.
It was pretty fun flying that remote-controlled helicopter, but when it crashed into a tree, after a while, I just left it there. How high do you think those clouds are?
When the big boy meets someone new, he always invites them to play tennis with him.
Sometimes people say, "Yes, I will play tennis with you, big boy." But that's because they do not yet know exactly who he is. They only find out once they arrive at the club and learn that their tennis game is scheduled for 2 hours later than big boy asked them to arrive.
All of the courts were reserved,
he dissembles. And it dawns on them over the ensuing 2 hours that what they thought was a simple tennis date to advance social networking and build new business contacts is, in fact, an 8-hour play date with the big boy.
Will you run with me to that tree over there?
The big boy has so far never lost this race. After he wins again, he flops onto the grass, belly up, arms spread, and gasping at the clouds high above.
What changed your mind about racing me?
Asks the big boy.
Was it because I promised you a bar of chocolate if you won?
It doesn't matter what you say. The big boy really thinks the bar of chocolate is the tipping point, and this makes him happy because it works every time, and every time he knows he will never have to pay up. You're listening to Stories About People. This story is called Third Man from the Left by Chris Ward.
My name is Roger. You've seen me, but you don't know me. And you won't recognize me.
Well, unless you have an eye for mind-numbing background details, in which case I pity you and your dull little life.
And well, I guess, hello. I know all about being in the background. I'm always there, absorbed into scenes of grandeur, drama, danger.
But adding little to them apart from color, context, reality, and detail.
I am quiet and do mostly what I am told. But I have ranges of emotion that no one ever asks for or wants to see. I live in never-ending hope that someday I might get to share them. But in the meantime, so it goes. Today, I am third man from the left in a small crowd on a New York street.
Of course, we're not actually in New York, as that's too expensive for this shitty film's budget.
But in Toronto. I'm trying to pretend it's summer.
When it's actually 20 degrees Fahrenheit.
And I'm doing my damnedest to stop shivering. I'm part of a crowd who will all soon be dead when the death quells of Kran land in their vast warships to destroy NYC for the thousandth time.
There are no quells or vast warships. That's all added in post-production. Instead, there's someone in a cherry picker waving large balloons around and three poor fools in blue spandex jumping up and down.
In front of us to scare us. And I'm doing my best to stop laughing. But hey, this is my life and I'm used to it. You may not know me or care about me, but I'm still a professional. No, scrap that. I need the money. And I've got a job in this dream-destroying industry, even if it sucks. Once the Quells have killed us with their stingrays, or was it singerays? Christ, I don't know, or care what nonsense these writers have come up with for me not to say. After they've killed us, in comes the hero to mourn humanity and save the day from Quellkind or Quellians or Quellness or whatever they're called.
Captain Awesome is the hero in this film, and it's some vain attempt to invent a new superhero that might appeal to millennials.
The captain doesn't have any powers of his own.
But has a cell phone with magical apps.
That was given to him by some nutty professor, or it was plugged into a nuclear power plant, or came from an alien world. I forget.
The apps fire lasers, create force fields, expand the phone into a surfboard-sized object that can fly.
And some other ridiculous uses that I'm sure the writers make up just to make sure he can escape any situation, or frankly, probably just to sell toys to kids. The captain has a handful of dumb catchphrases he uses when in a fight, like,
feel the Oz.
When he first enters a fight and pulls his phone out of his pocket.
Punched and posted.
Because apparently defeating world-crushing foes isn't enough. He's also got to share the moment with his millions of fans on social media too. What do these writers learn in writing school these days?
The actor who plays the captain is a jerk, but everyone loves him because he's got the right chin, or teeth, or car, or money, or connections.
I always try to be professional and friendly with all the jerks I find myself working with, but this guy is King Jerk and ignores most of us inferior beings. Anyway, back to me. Me and four other poor motley fools are all standing in a New York street doing normal people things.
Like hanging around in a New York street doing jack shit. Because apparently that is what normal people do on a daily basis. Who knew?
I must have missed that memo. Because all five of us are desperate to be noticed and given a proper role, we're all completely overdoing it. Trying to find our motivations, planning our backstories and life stories, when all we're supposed to be is
five people randomly stood on a New York street for no discernible reason.
Oh, and I mentioned we're actually in Toronto, didn't I?
Well, the set dressers spent 2 hours covering a big smoke burger sign with a Brooklyn bagel sign. Some sucker was up painting all night.
When they started putting it in place, they noticed the idiot had accidentally written Brooklyn Beagles instead and just chucked it.
And fired their ass, of course.
Anyway, where was I? Yeah, we're hanging out on this street going about our goddamn business like people in New York apparently do, thinking about how they're going to cover the rent for their shitty apartment or something. Then the Quell warships come descending.
Guys on a cherry picker with balloons if you weren't keeping up.
Crushing some random buildings as they land, and then we're all supposed to run quaking in fear.
From balloons. But hey, you're pros.
In different directions, when the Quells emerge and fire their zingers at us.
Some a megaphone.
Then we all collapse into a bloody heap where we stand. Fake blood spraying in every direction as we crash into dumpsters, bus stops, concession stands and walls. Oh, I didn't mention the fake blood, did I? I hate that crap. It takes hours to wash it off. And I have a date tonight, and that's not a nice look.
Fortunately, this shit show is on a tight budget, and we've only got the money for one blood shot, so we're shooting the lead up first.
And it was a good thing too, as Captain Arswipe,
Awesome.
Keeps forgetting his lines. He's supposed to enter the frame as we're all splattered to the ground and declare,
"Get the quell out of my city or prepare to be posted."
But clearly his perfect chin got all the good genes. And despite it being something a five-year-old could cope with, he keeps flubbing the line. And we've all got to pick ourselves up off the ground and get back to our original positions. For me, that's third man from the left. My role for this job. For what seems like the 20th time today, I dust myself down and prepare to fear the balloons. I better message Greta and let her know I'm going to be late for that date.
You're listening to Stories About People. This story is called The Egyptian by Susie Carlick.
The G train doesn't go anywhere except to George's place in Queens. I never see anyone I know at the Metropolitan stop getting on it. But I take it a couple of times a week to Jackson Heights to see George, and we have a good time, George and I. We drink a few beers, maybe watch a movie, make love. G is for G train. G is for George. I've been dating George for a couple of weeks, and I'm beginning to recognize the people on the G. It's an unusually quiet train. Working mothers, young businessmen, people with families and decent jobs and dreams that aren't out of reach. Sort of a middle-class train. I mean, middle-class by Greenpoint standards, by Jackson Heights standards. A regular folks kind of train. Except for one, the Egyptian. He's tall and his skin is quite dark. His features are sharp and Eastern. He has an air of shyness about him, like his suit has an air of being behind a desk all day. I have no idea if he's really Egyptian. He could be Indian or Pakistani, but I start thinking of him as the Egyptian. I notice him every time I'm on my way to George's, because I always go at the same time of day. And the Egyptian notices me, I think, too. He's exotic and handsome and gentle with his newspaper that he hides behind every time he catches me catching him looking at me. I'm amused. It's sweet. I'd like to tell George, but he'd never understand. Too jealous. So I keep the Egyptian to myself, my own little amusement, my secret admirer on the G train. My secret.
This is 7th Avenue. This is the Queensbound G train. The next stop is 4th Avenue, 9th Street. Stand clear to close the door.
Because I don't tell my friends either. I don't tell anyone at all. And now I find myself looking for the Egyptian, hoping for the Egyptian, straining for a glimpse of the Egyptian on the platform, straining for a glimpse of me whenever we pull into the 21st Street station. Too shy to struggle a smile for him, but too intrigued to look away immediately when he gets onto my car again. And when he's not there, I panic a little inside, and I get to George's, maybe not as bright and happy to see him as I should be. When I do see the Egyptian, oh joy, Eventually, we stop looking away to hide behind his newspaper or my book and spend the seven stops between 21st Street and Jackson Heights looking at each other instead. But we never say a word. Maybe it's more magical this way. Maybe we're both too shy or overwhelmed. But we stay quiet, silently looking. I'm starting to feel guilty, like I'm having an affair with George. The Egyptian doesn't know about him, but he would be hurt if he did. I want to say I'm sorry. I want to beg his forgiveness and tell him I never meant to hurt him. I want to tell him that I never meant to use the G-train this way, and if I'd known beforehand, I would have stopped seeing George immediately. One day, I do stop. George and I break up. It doesn't really hurt, but I panic a little inside about the Egyptian. For some weeks, I can't seem to remember the exact time I'd go see George. I try to retrace my steps and my pace and my timing, but it's never right again. I've lost the Egyptian. That really hurts. That makes me cry.
This is 4th Avenue 9th Street, transfer to the R train. This is a Queensbound G train. The next stop is 5th and 9th Street. Stay clear to close the doors.
A couple of years later, I'm temping around 59th and Broadway. It's lunchtime, and I'm pushed into the crosswalk by the hungry crush of office workers with lunch hours ticking away. Halfway across, I look up and find the Egyptian's eyes, and he looks down and finds me. But the crush is too strong, and neither of us can turn against it. We are each of us carried to opposite sides of the street. I turn on the sidewalk and look back to see if he is looking back at me. He is. We stand there, looking at each other across the great divide of Broadway as long as we can, until a city bus disappears us from each other forever. Again. This story is called A Family Conversation by Chris Ward.
A large, white, empty room. The kind of room where everything echoes.
If a pin dropped, its sound would carry into every corner, filling the room from top to bottom with wave upon wave of pin-dropping sounds.
The room has no perceivable walls or method of entry. There must be some somewhere.
Right.
The room is white. We have already established that, but not just any white. It is the kind of white that you can only dream of.
A clear, crisp, pure, glowing white that never gets dirty, never fades, and is definitely not off-white.
There is very little in the room. Its sparseness speaks volumes, positively shouts with its lack of substance.
There are two items in the room that stand out against the vast, stark nothingness.
A small, brown wooden table stands in the middle of the room. Well, as close to the middle as we can imagine.
Upon it stands a phone, an old Snoopy phone. Its wooden base perfectly matching the table it rests upon.
Snoopy looks cheerful in a way that only Snoopy can. After all, he matches the room in color.
Woodstock stares on. He seems happy in his place.
There doesn't appear to be a wire connected to the phone.
His presence would disturb the perfect whiteness and the layout of the room.
But there has to be one.
Right?
There is silence, peace, quiet.
All is still. Nothing moves. Nothing stirs.
Cutting through the immutable silence is the ringing of a phone.
Surprisingly, considering its lack of lead, it is the Snoopy phone.
Crazy, huh?
From an undetermined location, slowly strides a figure, heading towards the small wooden table and the phone.
As it moves, it yawns, stretches, scratches, and tuts and grumbles with frustration.
It lifts the receiver from Snoopy's hand. Snoopy seems relieved. He had been holding it for some time now.
What do you want?
Well, that's a nice way to greet your father. No, how are you? Or nice to hear from you. It's been so long. Sometimes I don't know why I bother calling anymore.
Father, you know I've been busy and somewhat occupied. Even I get tired and exhausted sometimes. I haven't really got time for one of your chats right now.
That's great. You haven't got time for me. I bring you into this world despite all the barriers, look after you, help you through the bad times, give you a place to stay when you wanted to come home, and now just because you found your chutzpah finally, you don't want to talk to me anymore. A fine state of affairs.
There is an awkward silence. The figure in the room drops their head and groans a groan like no other.
Groan layered with unsaid history, agendas, power plays, and expectations.
They push their long brown hair back and thoughtfully tuck a strand behind their ear.
They sigh in resolve.
Father, we have always had a complex relationship. We both know that, even if we've never really understood it or known how to handle it. I truly appreciate what you've done for me over the past few centuries, and we both know that I had to leave again when the time was right. I'm sorry that that time took longer than we both expected, but now it's upon us and taken me by surprise, and I really have got quite a lot to do in a very short space of time.
Hang on, back up there. What do you mean by now it's upon us?
There was an awkward pause as the figure holds the Snoopy phone to their breast and ponders their next move.
They lift the phone back to their mouth, taking a deep breath.
Dad, this is awkward. Did no one tell you?
Tell me what? An arm reaches from the body.
The arm is within a voluminous white sleeve. It looks like a monk's robe. But it must be a dressing gown, right?
No one wears robes anymore, do they?
At the end of the arm is a hand. It's a thin hand.
Its fingers are covered with old calluses.
The hand has a large, faint red mark in the middle of it.
Must have been a big wound.
The hand grabs a red stress ball that has miraculously appeared on the brown wooden table and squeezes it. Hard.
The ball has the logo of an anonymous insurance company, proudly emblazoned on it, and is proud to be fulfilling its function.
Dad, I don't know how to tell you this, but the end of times is upon us. We have 2 weeks. Hence, I'm pretty busy sorting out my case, and...
What?
Booms the voice at the end of the line. Booms in a manner that fills every fiber of existence with simultaneous life and destruction.
It is a voice of eternal knowledge, a voice filled with history, love, hate, and an indiscernible accent and gender.
It is the voice of God.
Why in my name did no one tell me? Jesus, Jesus, have I really become such a feared tyrant that people don't want to talk to me anymore?
Well, Father, you have become a bit distant the past few decades. People are a little more reluctant to talk to you right now.
Distant?
Boomed the voice in a manner that would shake all the fittings in a room, if there were any in this room. Good job there aren't.
A bloody god, not some
mamby-pamby-damned guidance counselor. People should fear and respect me. They should tell me everything. No, in fact, I demand to be told everything.
See, this is what I mean, Father. These days, people demand a bit more from their service providers. You can't just be there, demanding attention and expect to get it. You have to work hard for a slice of the market. Let's face it, you have a bit of an image problem.
The voice at the end of the line sighs an almighty sigh.
It starts many sentences and finishes none.
It is too used to things on its own terms, but too set in its ways to change.
It decides to change the topic.
So, how did you know about it, Jesus?
Whilst I was preparing my case, I picked up on a dream someone was having about the end of the world. You know as well as me that most of the time these things are hoaxes, but I checked this one out, and it was the real deal. They had it right.
Some kind of a new messiah character, are they? Will we need to worry about them causing us any problems?
No, not at all. No one will notice this guy. Nothing to worry about.
And dare I ask how the world will end?
Depressingly mundane, I'm afraid. Just a human making a mistake.
To think we spent all that time planning and propagating myths about the catastrophic end of times. The four horsemen will be seriously pissed that they won't be needed after all.
Not to mention the angel of death.
And Satan. Satan was really looking forward to devouring souls on Reckoning Day. I can't wait to tell that smug Apostle John about it, though. He spent all that time dreaming up these lofty visions of the end of days, and all he needed to really write was someone in an office stuffed up.
Yeah, that wouldn't have made the Bible so well, would it? Or imagine all those works of fiction just being about some boring human making a mistake. I can't imagine Hollywood going for that, can you?
Jesus and God laughed together for an uncannily long time. It's been a while since they have.
They both sigh in relief. The tensions broke by a mutual amusement at the suffering of others. So, Father, what are we going to do next? When it's all over, I mean.
Oh, don't you worry, Jesus. I've got a few ideas, as I always do. Want to come over tomorrow and take a look at some of them? Jesus breaks a smile.
Sure, Father. That sounds great. It'll be nice to work together again.
You've been listening to Stories About People with Chris Ward and Susie Kolick, recorded and produced in Berlin. Find out more about us at storiesaboutpeople.site.